Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, wherever you may find yourself around the world.
Hello and welcome to DeveloPod. My name is James Taylor, and on today's episode, we're going to do part two of our special follow-up on our web carnival on queerness and race that took place at the end of 2020. And this was an online conference, and the videos are available for all of the sessions to our members. So if you want to watch any of the sessions that you may have missed, they were sent to you in an email recently. But in today's programme, we're going to look at two of the presentations in particular, and we've got interviews with two of our presenters. The first interview is with Taylor Vieira, a teacher and teacher trainer based in Brazil, who is going to be talking to Christian. And then that will be followed by an interview that I did with Akemi Iwasa, also a teacher based in Brazil. Both of these presentations were focused on the race side of the conference. So if you want to find out more about the queerness aspect, in the previous episode, Christian spoke to Adam Scott. Okay, so let's kick off with Taylor. So I'm going to pass you over to Christian.
Taylor, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the virtual studio.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently gave a talk at the Web Carnival, which was held by TDSIG in conjunction with GI, Global Issues SIG. And your talk was entitled Teaching of Pronunciation, Supporting the Black Lives Matter Movement. When did you first become involved and interested in making your materials more racially diverse and inclusive?
Well, I think it was something around 2005, 2006, when I went back to grad school to study about media and education, because I always have this feeling, this sense of discomfort when it came to representation in general. I didn't see myself or sometimes my family and even my students being represented in the media and therefore not in the current materials. And then there we kind of questioned and studied a little bit in depth, like the motivations of why things are or were, because things are changing a little bit, hopefully, why things are the way they are, and the industry that is behind that. So that made me a little bit more aware of why materials are normally very whitewashed, Eurocentric. And then my initial focus was on diversity from an LGBT point of view. But I soon discovered and realized that it was not just about LGBTQIA people. Representation needs to be on each and every level, and that includes race, that includes Black people, which was the focus of the talk, and I haven't really stopped since then.
So what paradigm shift do you propose in terms of making teaching of pronunciation more inclusive?
Well, I think first we need to acknowledge that learners do not necessarily, most of the time, want or need to have so-called native-like pronunciation. And by that, we mean RP and General American, which are just idealizations of the language. Okay, there are people who speak RP, and there are people who speak General American, but numerically speaking, these people are not the majority at all. So I think we need to first acknowledge that. And as I said during the talk, and the purpose of the talk was also to show our students other models. And in the talk, I talked about three different Englishes, three different Black Englishes, because ultimately, okay, there has been some improvement when we think of the way that Black people are represented in any ELT materials, but ultimately, just the pictures. So what about the way that these people speak in other places other than the United States and the UK? So why can't we use, for instance, a sample from South African class? Why not piece of audio from Nigeria, from Ghana. I specifically focused on these three places. Someone once questioned me, well, but when you think about these places that you mentioned, they're former British colonies, and then English has kind of changed and kind of evolved into something else. So Nigerian English is not really English. That's what it was asked. And it really shocked me a little bit because sometimes people can't tell the difference. And yes, Nigerian English is not RP. Just like American English, general American English is not RP. So why do we think and feel that one variety is okay and another one isn't?
So you focus on those three particular countries. Can you perhaps say what are the main principles now that you follow in terms of teaching a pronunciation and making it more inclusive?
Well, I think the very first would be having these people from these countries specifically and other countries as well as models, as pronunciation models. Okay, so you mentioned India, for instance, and you're teaching the word table. That's the way I speak, for instance. But why not having an Indian person as a model in class or showing that as a possibility of a model, a person saying something like table, that is perfectly intelligible, perfectly fine. And perhaps that's going to be easier for your students to articulate it like that. In the talk, I specifically mentioned Nelson Mandela's R in the word recognize. Mm-hmm. And he speaks it in a way that sounds more like recognize, which is also a way that some people in the UK pronounce the word and that specific sound. So the very first thing is that making sure that these people are used as models because they are perfectly intelligible and valid models of good English, good pronunciation. Mm-hmm. The second thing would be to make sure that students develop an awareness of their own pronunciation. So, okay, so my Brazilian students have a hard time with the R sound. They tend to say it in a way, especially the ones here from Rio, they tend to say it in a way that sounds like a sound. So they would say something like recognize, which might not be intelligible for a lot of people. And then, okay, so we learned the word recognize, and here is a perfectly intelligible speaker who happens to be a native who says recognize. Which one do you think is easier for you to pronounce? Because you're pronouncing it this way, and this way might really not be the best way because a lot of people are going to have difficulty to recognize that you're producing that specific sound. So then we have, again, the sense of awareness and the sense of agency. Okay, so perhaps if I, as a learner, say recognize, that's going to be easier for me to remember because recognize is much more distinct than recognize. So there you go. You are, as a learner, deciding which route you want to take and how you want to sound. And you know why you're sounding that way. Because in the first place, the teacher was not correcting your accent. The teacher was correcting a pronunciation error that could potentially be a problem when we think of intelligibility.
Yeah, it sounds like you're giving the students information to empower them with those choices in terms of intelligibility. Yeah. So to be perhaps even more specific, can you describe an activity you might use to ensure that the teaching of pronunciation is more inclusive in the classroom?
Yeah, I think a very good thing is to always start with meaning. So you can do a quick listening exercise there, and then you decide whether you want to do something that is more just related, something that focuses more on details, on specific information. Because more often than not, learners feel very self-conscious when it comes to pronunciation, really overwhelmed. So going for the meaning first to make sure that meaning is clear and they understand all the words that are said there, I think that's usually a good idea. And then isolating the parts, the bits that you want to work with, because, for instance, you may want to work with vowel sounds, you may want to work with consonant sounds, with stress intonation, whichever feature that you decide to work with, and make sure you have those clips for them to be able to hear them over and over again. Because for learners also, when we have especially longer segments, it's very difficult for them to be able to spot exactly what you want them to notice. And then something you can do is work on awareness. Okay, so how would you say this? How would you say this sentence? How would you say this word? Do you notice anything different in the way that you say and the way that she says those words? And really starting with this noticing exercise. And then from there, after you have built the sense of awareness, you can say, okay, so the way that you say it or the way that we tend to say it here in Brazil is sometimes going to be problematic because of this sound. The sound is very important for intelligibility in international context. Whereas this other sound here, it's great that you're actually to pronounce it, but it's not so important. So it's really up to you. And then you give the learners that sense of agency that I was talking about and of awareness. And then you can do some the usual listen and repeat, have them try it out, because that's also very important. So for them to be able to reproduce things, it can just be on a theoretical level of, okay, so I speak this way, she speaks this way, perhaps I want to speak that way. So they need to also have opportunities for practice. And then you can just follow a more common approach of more controlled practice at some point and then having some free practice. Something that I talked about during the talk, and I also want to reinforce here, is that more often than not, teachers do not work with pronunciation in class because they're not confident about their own pronunciation and because they think that they have to be pronunciation specialists and know all the terms and the positions. And I mean, I think it's great if you as a teacher know those things because, this technical knowledge is really going to make your life easier, but you don't have to use that terminology with your students. So you don't have to be a pronunciation specialist to work with pronunciation. And you certainly do not have to be a pronunciation specialist to help debunk those myths and include people that need to be included in your lessons.
On top of the benefits of inclusivity, this will have benefits in terms of helping students to decode language and to learn the nuts and bolts of pronunciation.
Absolutely, because ultimately, that's one of the reasons why you teach pronunciation, because they need to speak and be understood, but also because they need to listen and understand. And those things go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And more work on listening needs to be done. That's why I like to start with listening, start with meaning. And then, as you said, decoding things, which is something that unfortunately we don't do as often as I think we could or should, mm-hmm. and then dissect those things and doing some pronunciation work.
But from an inclusive model, which is loosely based on the lingua franca core, and taking mm-hmm. into mind aspects of intelligibility, as you said before. Okay, so what sources of pronunciation would you recommend for students looking to curate their own materials to make models of pronunciation more inclusive? Because let's face it, course books, I've been trying to do a better job, but they're certainly not perfect, right? So what kind of sources would you recommend?
Well, first thing, congratulations for trying, because I think that's the very first step to a more inclusive learning space, a safer learning space, because the classroom becomes a safer environment once you can see yourself in the materials and not just see yourself in a superficial way, like, okay, there is a Black person on the cover of the book, so I, as a Black person, can relate to that. That is a very superficial way, a very superficial level. But actually listening to those voices and to what these people have to say, you don't need to include Black people only to talk about racism. Black people are also journalists. They are also celebrities. They're also doctors. So keep that in mind. There is, unfortunately, something bad when it comes to finding those samples, because commercially, I think people haven't understood yet that they need to be there. So not much investment is made in that regard, I'm afraid. But there are two websites that I would like to recommend. The first one is Ello, and Ello is with the triple L, ELLO.org. And I like that website because you have some audio lessons, some video lessons there, and you can filter by the nationality. So if you want to have a Nigerian speaker, you can do that. Unfortunately, the archive is not really extensive, I'm afraid, but that's a starting point. Something that you mentioned when we were talking about before the recording was IDEA, the International Dialects of English Archive, and that is dialectsarchive.com. And again, you can filter, and it's really interesting because there first there is a passage that normally speakers are invited to read, and then they have an anecdote that they tell, so then you can see how they sound more naturally. But then, as I was saying, unfortunately, there isn't much out there. So what I would really recommend is that teachers use authentic materials in that sense. And the good news is that the Nollywood film industry, and when they say Nollywood, I'm usually referring to the Nigerian film industry, but it kind of encompasses other sub-industries, such as the one from Ghana, from other places in West Africa. And more often than not, you can see that content on Netflix. Netflix is a great place, I would say, for you to find those authentic materials. There is a very good content that Netflix makes also coming from South Africa. So it's really about also you as a teacher consuming that kind of content. And you as a teacher getting acquainted as you can with those realities and those voices and those narratives, and then bringing those narratives and those voices to your classroom.
Super. And a question that was actually asked in slightly different terms, but during your webinar, how might you begin to deconstruct prejudice in the classroom when it comes to some perhaps in inverted commas native model of pronunciation that a student sees as desirable? So I think this was a teacher who considered herself, I think, native in inverted commas, and students were coming to her, and against her better judgment, they were asking her about pronunciation and models, and seeing her as the ultimate oracle, if you like, and the one to go to. And she was trying to deflect that. How might you begin to deconstruct that?
I think first we need to understand students' motivations, because there might be various reasons why somebody specifically says that they want to sound like a native speaker of English. And I think a very good way to make them think about these things is by asking questions. For instance, okay, you want to sound like a native, but a native from where? And more often than not, students don't know how to answer that question. They say, well, teacher, like a native speaker. Oh, no, from the USA. And then you say, okay, so we have many different accents in the United States. Like, is there a specific state that you want to focus on and why? And then I think they start questioning why they have those goals in the first place. There are people, on the other hand, that for some reason, they're going to live at certain places and they feel that they might be more accepted in those communities if they speak a certain way. And I think then it becomes a little bit more complicated, because I don't feel that I am in a position to tell someone, okay, so you really don't need to do that. Your English is fine the way it is. Because I've never been in those situations. And even though it's a horrible thing that somebody feels that they need to speak a certain way to be accepted, it's not a position that I've ever been in. So I would then be more careful. But 90% of our students are not in those positions, thank God. And then once you start questioning their motivations, usually they say that they actually want to be understood. That is normally their true motivation. They want to be understood. They want to be successful communicators. And then for that, they do not need to sound like native speakers. So those are the things that I would normally do. Ask them questions so they could realize what their true pronunciation goals are and go from there and help them with those.
What you say has been extremely useful. Perhaps it might be helpful for listeners if you could summarize. What advice might you give a teacher who's looking to ensure that the teaching of pronunciation is more inclusive in the classroom?
Well, so first thing is you as a teacher, you need to be in contact with a variety of accents, a variety of Englishes, and look at those from a non-judgmental way. In the talk, I specifically talked about native Englishes, but we can and we should also work with non-native English, because first, that's a need that students have. Students are likely to be speaking to other non-native speakers of the language. And each of these people will have some kind of, I don't want to say interference, but some kind of trait from their L1. And there are many good books that can help you with that, help you understand other English. Is a very good book, very good starting point, is Robin Walker's Teaching the Pronunciation of English as a Lingua Franca. I really recommend that. It's a great source. And like you said, you don't need to be a pronunciation specialist. You don't need to. I would very much like you to, but you don't need to do tons of research. You can discover those Englishes and those varieties with your students as you work with them. Again, we have that sense of agency. So the students choose how they want to speak and how they want to sound. Mm-hmm. And if they want to have bits and pieces from everywhere, that's fine, as long as they can be understood.
And through exposure to a greater range of different Englishes, and also through these noticing exercises that you recommend to integrate into your class, and that gives students great agency. That's a word that's really jumped out from what you've said, in terms of making their own choices in terms of pronunciation, and particularly the production of their English. Thank you, Taylor. Really, really fascinating, and something we all need to think about a little bit more, perhaps, and definitely integrate more.
Well, thank you for having me. And I really love talking about pronunciation. It happens to be one of my favorite topics. And whenever I can talk about the intersectionality of pronunciation and inclusivity, I'm super happy to do so, because ultimately, we live in a very unfair world. And everything that we can do in class to make that divide a little less extreme, I would say, I think we should be doing so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and hopefully the divide comes down altogether. But small steps, right? Thank you, Taylor, for your part. It's been really enlightening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For our next interview, we're going to be joined by Akemi Iwasa. She is based in Brazil and is an academic consultant at Troika, has worked with social responsibility in education for the past 10 years, and is currently undertaking postgraduate studies in human rights and corporate social responsibility. Hi, Akemi. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, James. So happy to be here.
We're very happy to have you. So you did a presentation at our Web Carnival, and the title was, Shall We Talk About Racial Disassociation? So I thought first it might be useful for our listeners for you to tell them what you mean by racial disassociation.
All right. For me, this is a quite recent concept, honestly. I am from an Asian background. I'm Brazilian, but I have Asian heritage. And for me, like throughout most of my life, this was quite of a blurred idea because it's not so common in Brazil. I remember in the presentation, we even talked about like the number of Brazilians of Asian heritage, which like less than 1% of the population. So talk about race was not something that was part of my life for most of my life, you know. But there was always something like quite strange about me. There was this feeling of never identifying with being like fully Brazilian, but not like being fully Japanese. Because, you know, I've never been to Japan. So although my family comes from Japan, this was also not part of my life. So recently, I found out about this concept of racial dissociation, which is this idea that even though for our generation of people with Asian background, we don't feel, we are not like physically threatened, or we don't feel that society rejects us. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we don't feel that we are integrated in society as well.
Yeah.
So racial dissociation is quite this this space where you don't feel physically part or psychically part of that, but you also don't feel excluded. So you actually feel like nowhere.
I see.
So the idea of the concept is a bit of this. It's like you understand that you don't feel... people are not directly biased toward you, but there is this thing there that you're still not part of the group. You still don't feel included in the group. So this is this feeling that you're not here nor there.
I see.
And
yeah.
What people found out is that people that feel this, we have this kind of anxiety, you know, anxiety in everything that you do, because you never feel like you belong. And when I first read about that, I really understood what I felt my whole life.
And you mentioned your, you know, how important this was to you personally. And I mean, throughout the talk, you sort of spoke about your own personal experiences. And so yeah. how do you think they have informed your view?
For me, when I first found out about the Web Carnival and the theme, I felt like I wanted to tell this story because this was the first time I talked about that. In other conferences and in other courses, I talked about, you know, looking at diversity and working in a more inclusive way and bringing inclusive practices to our lessons, to our materials, but I never talked about how I felt, you know, about all that. So for me, this conference was the opportunity. It was like a safe space, like as I said that in the beginning of the presentation, to share a bit of these feelings. And since I found out that what I felt had like names and other people feeling the same, I think it was, it could be, you know, helpful for somebody else if I shared that. So it was a very personal presentation. I remember I shared some pictures, you know, of my life and tried to match things that I felt during my whole life with these concepts and new ideas that I've been studying. It's still something quite recent in my life, you know, to study about race connected to my life. For me, it was like a pleasure to feel that I could share that and people could understand and relate somehow.
Yeah. So would you say that was your main aim, was to communicate that idea, that feeling to the audience, or did you have some other aims in mind as well?
That's a nice question. I guess I would say that I had like two aims. Maybe communicate that, yes, would be one. And also to try to show that people from mixed heritage, we are often ignored. I mean, the things that we feel are often ignored because we have this idea that you have to be here or there. And when you're mixed, you're like, you don't know where you are. So I felt that maybe other people in the audience also had some kind of mixed heritage background and might be, you know, somewhere in the middle. And my story and everything that I was presenting could be a bit of, you know, their window to that. And they could see themselves in that as well. So I guess a part of the aim was to make people think about that. And I guess another part of my aim was make people feel that and connect that story to their own stories, because they might have something in common with that.
I want to pick up on a couple of the concepts that you spoke about during your talk, which I found really interesting. So I want to start with the idea of racial imposter syndrome. That I found that really interesting. Can you describe what that is for us?
Right. Well, to talk about that, in my situation, I would have to start talking about this idea of a myth that we call the myth of the model minority. You know, for people with Asian background and Asian heritage, there's this kind of myth that, you know, Asian people are smart, they're you know, they're genius, they always do, they always excel at things that they do. And many people in Brazil have this this idea, this concept about us. You know, like yesterday I was talking to a friend of mine that I, you know, I was a bit behind on the things that I studied in my postgrad degree, and I was telling her that, and she was like, oh, but come on, you're Japanese, you're smart, you're smarter than everybody. And I was like, no, no, it's not like that. So here in Brazil, we have this idea, at least, that, you know, people from Asian heritage are like super smart. And when you buy this idea, when you buy into this idea, it's always a huge pressure. So like my whole life was like, okay, I need to be smarter than everybody, because that's what everybody's expecting from me. But, you know, you can never be that smart, you know, because it's never like good enough. So there is a lot of, you know, in my life, in my adult life, at least, there was a lot of this constant imposter syndrome of never feeling that I was good enough for things, you know. But for me, this is a bit connected with this idea of racial imposter syndrome, that is not feeling that you are good enough in, like, not Brazilian enough, but also not, you know, Asian or Japanese enough. Sure. So I felt that, okay, I wasn't like super smart, or I did not have, you know, common characteristics with Asian people, so I wasn't Asian enough. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of differences for me, you know, when I looked at Brazilian culture, so I was not Brazilian enough. Mm-hmm. So this is the idea, this concept of racial imposter syndrome. It happens a lot with people from mixed background, because again, that's what leads to the feeling of racial dissociation. So you're not here, you're not there, so you're never good enough to be like anything.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, and moving it a bit more towards education, you quoted Emily Style, who spoke about a curriculum with mirrors and windows, which I thought was a really, really interesting metaphor. Can you expand on that for us?
Right. Yeah. I really like this idea as well. She talks about this idea of having mirrors and windows. And the idea of a mirror is like having materials and resources that mirrors your own experiences. So somehow through these materials, through this kind of representation in class, I can see my own stories, and this helps validate my experiences in the school world, you know, in the outside world. So it's important to have mirrors. It's important to have the opportunity for me to see myself, to see my story in the curriculum. But also, it's important to have windows. And the idea of windows is to have this look at stories of people that are different from you. Maybe different from you because, you know, they are, I don't know, they have different backgrounds. They live somewhere else. They work somewhere else. Or they have, you know, different stories with their race and sexuality. But then you kind of open a window to these people's lives. And this is an opportunity for you to get to know a different reality from yours, and also to develop, you know, empathy, because you're actually getting in touch with something that you might never have the opportunity to in your life, you know. But when you look at these other people's stories, it might give you a glimpse of something that is also part of your story. So when you look at windows, when you look at diverse stories, you might see a bit of a mirror there. You might see yourself reflected on these stories as well. And you see, I see what this person is going through. It's kind of similar to something that I've been going through as well. So this window turns into a mirror at times. I don't know if I could explain that clearly.
No, exactly. Yeah, but, yeah. I think it's a really a very clear metaphor for understanding the way that our curriculum should be designed, and our lessons, our lesson materials, course books, all of those kind of things. It should be something that we keep in mind as we're creating the materials.
But yeah, we always talk a lot about, you know, like representation. And I think the idea of windows is that, like, when you are concerned as a teacher, you know, to have all stories, diverse stories, and all people represented somehow, you don't know that maybe somebody could see themselves in the stories of somebody else.
Yeah.
So that's why it's so important for us as teachers to present students with this diverse backgrounds, diverse number of stories, you know, because,
yeah,
you know, maybe one of your students is struggling to understand where they are in the world. And if they only have mirrors, they will never get the opportunity to see something outside of what they already know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then at the end of your talk, you spoke about learners' rights, which again, right, I thought was a really interesting concept. The idea of rights for learners. Can you explain a bit about that?
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit about these rights of actually people from a mixed background, you know, and then I tried to apply this a little bit to learners and to the rights they have. But, you know, as a person, not only as a student, I always felt this need of, you know, like being something, being this and not that, you know, having labels, because somehow labels make our lives easier. That's how I felt, you know. But, you know, quite recently I found out that, you know, I have the right to, you know, not to define myself necessarily as one thing or another. I have the right not to justify my being in this world by being Asian or being, you know, Brazilian. And I think this quite applies to the rights of our learners, you know, because sometimes we try to fit them into boxes as well. And they have the right to not to be put in places, you know. And in my case, I felt that I didn't have sometimes the language to express the things that I was feeling. And I think our learners have the right to have the language to express what they're feeling as well. So that's why these kind of topics are so important in classes, because, you know, they have the right to be able to express themselves the way they want. But if they don't have access to that, how can they do that?
Thank you so much for joining us, Akemi. It was really interesting to find out more about your presentation.
Oh, it was my pleasure to be here. It was my pleasure, the presentation. I really liked the feedback that I got from people. It was really nice, especially people like in the same situation, people that are from mixed heritage background, and that's so what Brazilian people are like. So it was very nice.
Thank you, Kemi.
Thank you, Jane.
So a big thank you to Taylor and Akemi for appearing on the show. We very much appreciate it. If you want to watch their presentations, we've put links to them in the podcast description on the notes. So whether you're a TDSIG member or not, you'll be able to watch those presentations. If you want to catch up on any of the other presentations, those are available for TDSIG members. All you have to do is go to the ITEVL website, log in, go to your resources and go to the SIGs area, and there you'll find the link to watch the videos. If you want to stay in touch with TDSIG, then you can do so by following us on social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. Just do a search for ITEFL TDSIG, or you can check our website tdsig.org. If you want to make sure you stay in touch with this podcast, then the best thing you can do is hit the subscribe button in whichever podcast app you are using to listen to this, and the next episode will always automatically appear. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of DevelopPod.